Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fandamentals podcast. I am your host, Harley. Joining me on this episode is returning guest and host of the W-rated podcast, it's Daisy Edwards. Daisy was kind enough to come back onto the show and join me for the final episode of our sitcom summer series, and that is, of course, the US Office. We celebrate all things Dunder Mifflin here in this episode, including what it is we love about the show, the themes, the characters, and so much more. Yes, folks, this is a sitcom that is more than just a soulless remake, and we get into all the reasons as to why that is. There are, of course, a healthy dose of clips sprinkled in for good measure, as well as just a lot of laughs had along the way. So, without further ado, let's just get straight into the episode. This is the US Office with Daisy Edwards. Hello, Daisy, and welcome back to the Fandamentals podcast.
Thank you for having me again. I'm so excited to be back.
Yeah, no, thank you. You swooped in at the 11th hour and rescued what was, I think, has been built up as like the penultimate episode, or the ultimate end episode of this whole series. And yeah, thank God you did, because I was having a bit of problems with guests, but that's okay, these things happen.
You can count on me for my love for this particular show anytime that you need.
brilliant. Well, of course, yeah, you're here for the final episode, the US Office. I mean, it's an absolute banger of a show, and just I think to get straight into it, Daisy, I want to know, why do you love this show so much? Why do you agree to come onto the show for this episode?
It's a funny one, really, because it's not something that, like, I watched when it came out. I'm not even sure why I started watching it. I don't even think I really rated it that much when I did start to watch it, sort of the first few seasons. But somehow along the way, I've just become a little bit obsessed, and it's sort of secured itself in my consciousness of, like, pop culture references and just, like, memes and everything, as I've mentioned last time, is how my brain operates. Yeah. And it's just one of those ones that, like, when you finish it, it kind of latches onto you in an emotional way that you kind of just can't help but start again. And I think that's what's happened. It's just been like a rotation that it's basically always been on the decks, so to speak, of if you need a sitcom that's so easy to watch, it's going to make you laugh, and, you know, it's just a bit of a feel-good comfort watch, then that's just perfect to always have there on the go.
Do you know what? I think that's so spot on. I think that's a really good introduction, not just for yourself, but I think for a lot of people, particularly over here, you know, in the UK, because we wouldn't have got it. I think we've spoken about this before in other episodes, where sort of when this show was out, you know, the mid-2000s, terrestrial television and digital TV was sort of just coming into its own over here. And so occasionally we would get snippets of shows like this. And of course, we've done the UK Office, and that's such a beloved show over here. But yeah, I personally, like you, I wasn't really aware of the US version sort of growing up. It was only after the whole thing had done.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like you say, you see it on Netflix or Prime and you go, oh, yeah, okay, maybe I'll give this a go. And
because I'm not sure if it was shown, I don't know if you know, if it was shown on TV at all over here. I don't know if it was like on a Comedy Central or something like that, maybe. But that's, it would have been quite a while after its run, I reckon.
Yeah, I think that's when I first personally saw a couple of episodes. But again, that's like, we over here in the UK, we're really slow to catch up with the States in terms of TV channels and all that stuff. But, you know, I mean, I think it's one of those shows that I keep hearing more and more, especially now, people checking it out and seeing it for the first time. It's had a whole new life on streaming. It seems like it's apparently the biggest, like the most downloaded show ever, according to a lot of articles I've seen floating around. So, and I don't know about you, I feel like it's a show that's perfect for streaming. Like, it's 20-minute episodes. It's full of life and wonderful characters and so many great moments. And it's very comforting. Like, it's a show you can easily rewatch.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, I think it's perfect for streaming because it's so bingeable. I don't know about you, but I'll finish an episode. And I think maybe that's to do with the setting of the fact that it's in an office. You know, maybe some people would see this as a fault of the show, but a lot of the, and I know with other shows, you know, you have your specific sets that come back in, you know, Friends, you've got the Coffee House, Parks and Rec, you've got the offices and everything. But ultimately, the office is pretty much just the office.
Yeah.
Like from pretty much the same angle the whole time. And this sounds really boring for anyone who's not listened to watch this before, but actually it just means that a lot of the, you finish an episode and it's not like, oh, I'm starting a new episode now, because this is clearly about something different. These people are somewhere else. They're doing something completely different. You know, this is the day-to-day lives of people working in an office. And I think it kind of riffs quite beautifully on the fact that, you know, this stuff is quite repetitive in its nature of the setup, but that's why it works so well, is that it juxtaposes that mundanity with some really wacky stuff. But I think that's where the comfort comes in, is that it's so easy to quickly go on to a new episode, because there's nothing that's really changed for you to say, oh, this is a brand new episode, brand new storyline, this is and this. It's that feeling of, as you do, anyone that works in an office kind of might relate to, in that, you know, when you're going in to the office every day, it's kind of like, oh, back again, here I am, same old, same old. But there's always something different that happens that day. Granted, not anything as interesting as in this show, but the way that it starts is always like, oh, okay, it's a new day in the office. And you kind of, it's that comfort of, there's not really, it's not hitting you with this random storyline. It's that ease, it's so easy to get started into another episode, because there's just, it's just like, oh, walking into the office in the morning. I don't know if that makes sense, but I totally get it.
And I mean, of course, it's straight off the back of the UK version, and the UK has that setup as well, like you say. It's that that's why both those shows work as well as they do. And I think what made them so unique at the time as sitcoms, as you say, they weren't like familiar sets. It was just one place where all these things happen, and yeah, you as an audience member can put yourself almost in that room. I've been listening a lot to behind the scenes interviews. I've already mentioned it, but I mention it again. There's Office Ladies, which is a really good podcast with Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, go through it. And there's also Brian Baumgartner's series of interviews, which I highly recommend people check out. And I was even listening to one today with the director and writer. And he was talking about that, about like how important it was for them setting up, you know, angles with the camera. And they, you notice when you watch the show, like you said, as wacky as it is, all the stuff with the camera and the way that people are and when they're positioned, it's so realistic. And that was so important to them. Like, they didn't want any crazy big scopes or weird shots or tracking shots. It was just like, they wanted to do basically what you could physically, realistically do if you had an actual documentary crew there.
Yeah, and they stuck to that beautifully, didn't they? You know, through the storyline right up to the end and sort of the later seasons with the boom up sort of relationship with Pam and everything. And you kind of go, oh, wait, oh, yeah, this is like set as a mockumentary in the style of the camera crew actually there. And the way they wrap it up where they start watching the first episode is so beautifully done, because I actually finally finished Modern Family recently. And they never make any reference at the end. Spoiler to anyone who hasn't finished it. I assume anyone that watches it has, but they don't make any reference at the end to the fact that the whole time they've been doing talking heads to the camera. There's like no reference about the fact that it's a documentary. And I don't know if Parks and Rec do either, but I think that kind of, I don't know, I think it goes beyond the talking heads in a different way. Whereas The Office is so clearly rigidly in its documentary style, in the way that it is done. Whereas I think what you were saying about what it does and it stays, that I think Parks and Rec probably goes beyond that. It kind of escapes its box of a mockumentary, but this is what its appeal is that it's always done within the confines of a documentary. It doesn't let that kind of be a detriment. It kind of lets it breed creativity, and how can we make this, you know, more fun, and that bringing them into the storyline, and, you know, the cameramen getting knocked over and just like random stuff like that. Like running out when it's the fire alarm and you can see the cameramen running and everything.
And I think, like, to come back to something you just said a minute ago, like, it helps to kind of ground the show in a bit of reality, because of course you know, the key difference is when you look at something like this version and the UK version, and we'll get to some of them in a minute, but one is definitely that this is more fanciful, you know, in that there are certain things, big things that happen. And, you know, and you can kind of understand it because in the States, things are kind of larger than life, that, you know, that, that's part of the culture. And you, and again, you can kind of almost believe it. And again, they can get away with doing it because they've got more episodes. They've got just a whole different outlook. Whereas, of course, the British one, the whole point is meant to be very subdued and dour. And that's part of what it's all about and what makes it so great. But this one, that you're allowed to go in a different direction. And yeah, it's fascinating. Again, I highly encourage people to go and listen to those interviews with people behind the scenes, because it's stuff like that that you don't think about when you're watching it. But when you do, like you said, when, you know, the cameraman will hide or get knocked over and stuff, or they do spy shots and things, and you go, oh yeah, they really thought about it.
Dwight and Angela, you can see them kind of behind, and they make reference to the fact that they take their mics off, and it's just those little details, I think, that just shows that they put so much care into the show, even into the later seasons, that kind of, and that's always something that you appreciate as a viewer, that, you know, they clearly still care about this gem of an idea and keeping true to that. And I think what you were saying about the differences between the UK and the US is absolutely a reflection of the culture, because I don't think that the US version of The Office worked as well in its very beginnings as it does in its midpoint, because I think it was pretty much a copy of the UK, and that just doesn't translate, even as a UK audience watching the US one. That's not a US culture and sort of, I don't know, just atmosphere. So it just didn't quite sit right. And then it just came into its own. And you're right, that sort of, you do expect that larger than life stuff, because I'm not being funny, you know, reading what goes on in the US, even now, there's so many wild and wacky things that do genuinely happen
exactly
in America, as they do in the UK, but more so in America, I would say. So it definitely reflects, I think, the difference in culture. And I think that's why it works a lot better in the US once it comes into something a bit separate, specifically the Michael character, because obviously he was originally just going to be David Brent, but as soon as they decided that it doesn't quite work, I think that's when it differentiated in a very, very good way. And also then for diehard UK fans, didn't hopefully sort of taint the UK original too much. I guess some people are going to hate it regardless, because they don't want something that they love remade. But hopefully, like, for the most part, because they've tried to do something a bit different. Like, do you remember that they tried to do a US In Between Us?
I'd never seen it, but
I've only seen a clip, but that's an example of when it doesn't go well.
Well, there's stuff like that. I think of the US version of the IT Crowd's another one that, like,
I didn't even know that was a thing.
I don't think
I could even try that. I love the IT Crowd too.
But you're right, and do you know what, again, it's really funny listening to a lot of the interviews with it seems like all the cast and crew, everyone basically who was involved with this had a really high respect for the UK office. And if anything, it seems like all of them were worried. I mean, famously, John Krasinski said, like, in an audition, he inadvertently said to Greg Daniels, the showrunner, before he even realized he was the showrunner, that, like, he wasn't sure if this was, you know, a good idea. And he was like, I'm sure we're going to mess this up because the UK one's so good. And, you know, funny enough, he gets cast in it later on. But, like, it's funny, a lot of them were really determined to try and make something different whilst paying respects. And you're right, that, and often a criticism is, like, particularly of the first episode in particular, is, well, you know, it's a shot for shot remake of the pilot. And apparently that was on purpose. I didn't realize this, but according again to Greg Daniels, the whole reason he did it was to prove to network people that they could do it, that they had the cast, they could get the right people and go, look, we can do this. And then afterwards they were like, right, how do we pivot away from this now? Because you're absolutely right. The cultural differences, the sense of comedy, the sense of characters are very different between our two countries. And that's great. Yeah. And you think, like you said, any good adaptation needs to recognize its audience. And if there's something different about it, lean into that. And that what you've said actually about our main, our sort of leading man, you could say, Steve Carell's Michael Scott, I think is a great place to start with characters, because Yeah, he is definitely the place where you see the biggest changes, don't you, really? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, me and Josh talked for a long time about David Brent. and he's a great character, and there's so much you can pick up on him. But you're right. I think when you look at Michael Scott versus David Brent, you can see very clearly the differences in the show and which direction they wanted to go in with it.
It's funny that as soon as we started talking about this, it just reminds me of the episode where they meet, when David Brent has his cameo. And do you know what's funny? It's like, obviously they set it up very much to be like a mirror image of, you know, essentially him meeting, you know, his blueprint.
Yeah.
And there it became so clear where the similarities actually were, because I think, you know, Michael Scott became so much of his own iconic character.
Yeah.
In a way, I don't think anyone who would have seen the mid sort of series seasons would ever based on David Brent. But then in that little moment, you're a bit like, oh, okay, I can kind of see what's happening here. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's just testament to the fact that, obviously, as you were saying, like, they loved the UK one so much. But the debate and the conversation around adaptions, my opinion is always, you know, you have to, for it to feel like it's worth something, you have to breathe new life into it. And that's why I really don't connect with, like, the live action Disney remakes, for example, because I don't feel like what they're giving is anything close to what the originals gave. And, you know, whether they had planned from the beginning to sort of remake the UK for a certain amount of time, or whether it was just the first episode to kind of convince the stakeholders and then pivot into their own direction. Ultimately, it sounds like they didn't want to only do a shot-for-shot remake, and they kind of wanted to use it as a springboard to go into something else from a love of the actual show rather than just to cash in. So that's good. That's always a good place to start.
It is. It reminds me again of the conversation I had with Claire, you know, right back at the start of all of this, about Parks and Rec, and indeed quite a lot of other shows I've spoken about with people, that naturally the first season or two takes a little bit of time to warm up, and you figure out who the characters are. But yeah, definitely. I mean, something they establish early on with Michael Scott, like you say, to help differentiate their leading man from David Brent, is, you know, David Brent is a very self-destructive person with hardly any redeemable qualities. And of course, we spoke about it at the show, like, his kind of big redemptive moment is literally in the last moment of the last episode. And it's not like a complete arc. It's just him standing up to somebody for a brief second. Whereas with Michael Scott, they sprinkle in moments, even in the early seasons, where you sort of, you realize that you can feel sympathy for him, which I think is really clever. You know, like, I'm pretty sure it's the Dundies is the last episode of the first season. And there's a really good moment where, like, you know, he's doing the stupid award show and he's making jokes that are not funny and bombing, and everyone's kind of a bit fed up. And you're getting the cringe and the comedy and all the laughs out of that. But there's a really interesting moment where a couple of rowdy guys at the bar start, like, chiming in and having a go at him. And you as an audience are almost, like, taken back, and you're kind of like, oh, hang on a minute. No, this isn't funny. You're picking on him. And you start to feel like a little bit of sympathy for him. And there's lots of little moments like that they sprinkle in where I really think that helps you to kind of deviate a bit more. Because, like, something bad happens to David Brent.
To him it does, bit. Yeah. Yeah, I think that David Brent and Michael Scott, obviously, their archetype kind of, as you say, that sort of self-destructive, quite selfish, quite ignorant basis is the same. But I think what changes in terms of how it works with different UK US audiences is that you can take David Brent so much further with the UK audience, because I think the way that's set up is for people to laugh at, because they have had an old boss like that.
Sure.
And he's making a fool of himself through that. Whereas I think, in a way, and I've heard a lot of people say this about the US one, is that seeing Michael Scott being it kind of just put a bit of a downer on it. It just didn't quite land in the same way. Maybe because they didn't quite take it far enough, and maybe that's because just the way that the UK sort of comedy just takes it that little bit further.
Sure.
But it just became a little bit like, this isn't funny. I think it was like people always reference the bit with Pam and the message taking, and the fact that he's like, kind of puts his foot, throws her under the bus in front of Jan and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it just didn't work in the US. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
And kind of changing him slightly to be ultimately have a heart of gold and really, really care about everyone, and him just being dope.
Yeah.
That's why he comes across as a bit of an asshole. Just completely did a 180. In that sense, to still have that foundation be the same, but just completely feel it hits you differently. And I suppose that's where they really pivoted in that way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they describe him as basically similar to David Brent, but it's like it's 10% more hopeful, like as a character. And it's, you know, like, again, we talked about it, David Brent, his reaction when, you know, someone's upset by something that he said is to kind of just dig even deeper, you know, it's to dig himself in a hole and like defend his position. Whereas, you know, interestingly with Michael Scott, if he upsets or if when he realizes he's crossed a line with someone in the office, he gets emotional and he feels bad. And you kind of like, oh, okay. So you see, like, he's not a bully. He's just someone who's, like you say, a bit ignorant and maybe steps out of line.
I think that's the difference in that with David and Michael is that David... Yeah. Ultimately, his actions do come from a selfish place, whereas I think Michael's actions do come from, and I might be wrong because I haven't watched the UK one as much, as so people might be like, no, that's not true, but that was just my impression of the character, whereas Michael's is very much he's inadvertently selfish, absolutely, but it comes through, you know, him digging himself into a hole is generally because he's trying to do the right thing with people but just completely misses the mark.
The Michael Scott Foundation is still in existence.
There you are. I don't think we have finished with my inbox.
What's Scott's tot?
Has it really been 10 years?
Local businessman pledges college tuition to third graders.
Michael, why did you promise that?
To change lives?
No, Michael, why would you promise that?
You know, okay, I call the school, cancel. I can't go through with this.
We've already rescheduled 7 times.
Michael, this is a terrible, terrible thing you've done.
Well...
It's terrible. No. Just terrible. And the longer you put it off, the worse it's gonna get.
I fell in love with these kids, and I didn't want to see them fall victim to the system. So I made them a promise. I told them that if they graduated from high school, I would pay for their college education. I've made some empty promises in my life, but hands down, that was the most generous.
So I completely agree. Yeah, and it makes the character a bit more enjoyable, and you can kind of invest a bit more in him. And I have to say, just Steve Carell's performance in it is insane. And the fact that he never got an award for it is, to this day, I think, one of the greatest crimes in TV.
I wasn't sure. And I just assumed.
That's the thing.
He is so great.
I was listening to an interview today, and that's what they were talking about. They were like, I cannot believe that he didn't win. Because, you're right. You just assume watching it, you're like, oh, he must have got an Emmy for this at some point. Because the performance is phenomenal.
It's just got Emmy written all over it, to be honest. But What do we know?
I guess not, but I love him, and I love the way he interacts with all of the characters. You know, he's got this really great relationship with pretty much every character in the office, like the way he bounces off of them, and, you know, his ability to kind of just seems to like draw the best out of each other character. You know, I think of him and him and Dwight, for example, they have this really adorable relationship that it's like two loser kids, but one's like slightly less of a loser than the other.
That's really funny you say that, because I can see that kind of, that not stereotype, but that kind of type of character, you know, the two best buddies, like you say, they're not the popular ones, but one of them is really sort of like headstrong in that he doesn't care if he's a loser. He knows he's the best. And then you've got the other one who wants to make friends with everyone still. Yeah. Like, Yeah, I definitely can see that. I definitely recognize that in sort of other media. But, you know, as soon as you said Michael and Dwight, my head just went straight to assistant to the regional manager.
Is that, again, yeah, a nice carry-on joke from the UK. Mm-hmm. But again, because they've got this and they've got it for a lot longer, they take that and run with it. And it just leads to some really great moments. And
loads of payoffs. Those little details, yeah. I think, what work well. And I think, obviously, the UK has set it up in a way that's great. Mm. But ultimately, as you say, they've had so much more time to develop this that they don't forget those roots. They don't forget those setups. And they do end up paying off in that way. You know, when he eventually gets the role and things like that, it's just little nods. And it's actually quite emotional because you know how far that it's come in that way, and it means something for these characters. Obviously at first it's a joke, but you do actually care about Dwight sort of having that job, because that he's worked like so hard for essentially up until that point.
No, exactly. And it's so much great interplay with them, and even some of the stuff, I mean, I think about That's What She Said jokes. Like, you feel like they're just kind of everywhere now, but you kind of forget that, like, again, Michael Scott in The Office brought those into the mainstream.
Exactly. It's just a perfect way of like just symbolizing his kind of juvenile nature, and I think that that runs through in all of his relationships. And I think, do you know what, I think that's the humanity side of him that we're talking about, is that actually he's just a big kid. I think that's what that part of it is, and that's why you can have sympathy for him, because he's doing all these same things maybe that David Brent did, but maybe that's why you kind of feel sorry for him and you're like, oh, he's not quite getting it right, but you don't feel too bad. I think it's because he's got that kid kind of immature nature to him, where you kind of go, oh, he just doesn't know any better. Maybe that's what it is.
I think so. And I just think, I don't know about you, some of my favorite moments are when you kind of get a little glimpse into Michael Scott's past. You know, when he's telling stories about his mum and his stepdad, you're kind of like, oh, okay. So he's a child of divorce and there's clearly a lot of issues there every time he talks about them. And I just think of that amazing bit where I think it's like a bring your kid to work day, and he brings in a videotape of him on a kid's show.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know where I'm going with this. And it's I encourage people to look this up on YouTube. It basically just devolves. It's him showing this footage of him being interviewed as like a 5 or 6 year old. On this show, and they're like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And his answer is like, I want to have lots of kids so like no one can say no to me playing. And like, it's such a sad and tragic answer.
It always seems to happen, doesn't it, with Michael, in that he doesn't really understand. And again, this might go back to the kid thing, is that I don't think he ever really grew up, so he doesn't really understand how serious some stuff has happened to him, like what it actually means. And he kind of shares all this stuff with the rest of the office, and I think initially the rest of the office are like, you know, this is too much boundaries. I don't you know, I don't want to have to deal with all of this. But then over time they realize that, you know, he doesn't have those boundaries, and that's what makes him so great, in that they can have a genuine or authentic relationship with their boss, because he does care and he doesn't understand sometimes things, and they are there to help him understand those things. Well, I mean, you can go back to like the diversity day, like when he kisses Oscar and all of that stuff, like it's like, oh my god, this is so uncomfortable. But ultimately it's really nice in the way of, you know, he obviously there's the stat, I can't remember what it is, about how much time you spend with the people you work with compared to your own family, and that's basically what this show is built around. And it's quite nice actually to see this uncomfortable kind of a character be taught by people around him, like that his intentions are good, but the way that he goes about it is what brings the comedy. But then you've got the bit after that happens, which is him learning and growing as a person as well.
Of course. Yeah, that's it. And to him, the office is his family. You know, like the rest of the characters have family and relationships and people they go to. And it's very clear, the more you see of him and his character, that like he doesn't seem to have anyone outside of the office. So again, I think, like you said, it adds to that, those sort of layers to those characters. You're like, oh, okay, right. This is why he is the way he is, because he's a bit lonely and desperate. And again, like you said, it puts him in a position where he's coming from it in a more positive way. So you can be a bit more forgiving when he crosses a line or does something that is just really cringy.
Absolutely.
I mean, speaking of other main characters then, I mean, we've already mentioned him. And he's funny enough, he's top billed, actually. I've got it in front of me, IMDb. Oh. Yeah, Mr. Rainn Wilson as Dwight K. Schrute.
Oh. Can I just do a quick side note? My Xbox name is Daisy K. Schrute. And you know what? I always forget about it. And then Claire came over to mine the other day and I put it on to watch something. And I don't really game, so it's not something that I pay much attention to, the fact that I've got a name on there. And it loaded up my avatar and she just burst out laughing. I was like, what are you laughing at? She went, Daisy K. Schrute. I was like, oh yeah, forgot about that. It's iconic.
Yeah. Talk about lovable weirdos. Like,
right.
Just incredible. And I mean, again, like, he has that amazing interplay with Michael Scott, the kind of neediness and like you said, the desperate lust for power that's in so many of the seasons. And but again, like, there's something about his character that is kind of likable in a weird way.
Yeah, and I don't know how that works. Yeah, I really don't.
I think he gets truly terrible in a couple of seasons down the line. Like, there's a point I remember, I can't remember which season it is, but I know there's a point every time I rewatch it, I'm just like, oh yeah, this is when Dwight is kind of insufferable.
Mm. I mean, he shoots a gun in the office.
Yeah, exactly. Like, his ego just goes through the roof. But
yeah,
eventually, I think, he, like all of the characters, he does get a good send-off and he kind of gets to wind down. But, I mean, Rainn Wilson is just so good in the role. He's so ridiculously funny. And, like, I think I think he competes with Steve Carell for, like, some of the best talking heads and just coming up with, like, the most ridiculous stuff.
Absolutely. I'm trying to think of the one that just popped into my head where, I can't remember why, but he starts saying all of this, this plan where he basically is going to, like, I think he's going to steal something.
Steals and
he's
going to stand
someone up. Yeah, yeah. Something about Tiffany's. I can't remember it, but all I can remember is he finishes it. He's like, and I'd be gone the whole time or something. I can't remember
I will hunt that down and put it in because
it's
incredible, isn't it? It's so, he has this whole, like, crazy master plan for a heist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just stuff like that he does that, and you don't question it. You just kind of go, yeah, fair enough.
What is my perfect crime? I break into Tiffany's at midnight. Do I go for the vault? No, I go for the chandelier. It's priceless. As I'm taking it down, a woman catches me. She tells me to stop. It's her father's business. She's Tiffany. I say no. We make love all night. In the morning, the cops come and I escape in one of their uniforms. I tell her to meet me in Mexico, but I go to Canada. I don't trust her. Besides, I like the cold. 30 years later, I get a postcard. I have a son, and he's the chief of police. This is where the story gets interesting. I tell Tiffany to meet me in Paris by the Trocadero. She's been waiting for me all these years. She's never taken another lover. I don't care. I don't show up. I go to Berlin. That's where I stashed the chandelier.
I think it's such a good example of a character that throughout the whole series, you get so much through the text about his background. Mm. And they don't ever show it, but he has got such a rich personality.
Mm.
And it's just, like, more so than any of the other characters, I think, is that he, you know, through these talking heads and the way that he is, it tells you so much about the character without you having to know it, have seen any more about him compared to Michael or Jim or Palmer or anyone. But it's just, he's such a unique character. Like, he's got to be up there with one of the most sort of iconic and best fictional characters on TV. Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. I mean, he's a sort of German / Amish farmer salesman who's into heavy metal and, you know, and loves Battlestar Galactica. It's some really odd choices of things they just kind of mesh together. And then none of them make any sense. You're like, wait, what? All of this in one person?
But now it's like, and if you say any of that, it's your mind automatically goes to him.
I mean, Bears, like, beats Battlestar Galactica. It's, you know.
Right?
It's so
what
good.
Kind of bear is best? He knows.
Yes, he knows. Yeah.
If you're ever unsure, he knows the answer.
There are two schools of thought. Yeah. It's just like, what? What are you talking about?
Do you know what's great? He's thought about everything.
Yes.
Everything there is to know about the universe, Dwight has a plan, a thought, an opinion. Like,
Yeah.
It's just all, it's incredible, really, like the way that they've written his character to just be the best of the best, but only in his own mind.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, I feel like as well, it ties in slightly to the whole Michael Scott thing where, like, they'll show you, you know, evidence of him being good at sales and being a good boss. They do that with Dwight. Like, they show that, like, he's not just the office weirdo. Like, he's fiercely good at sales because he doesn't have a filter. Like you say, because he's so confident in who he is, he's a very aggressive salesman, but it works. You know, like, I think one point you find out that he's been, like, the top salesman in the whole company, like, for several years going, because he just doesn't have a filter. He just goes straight in.
Yeah, and that's really good at the juxtaposing against someone like Jim, who is good, but he doesn't have that drive. Well, he ends up, like, you know, having a similar sort of growth and sort of arc as Dwight. They both have the same job at some time, at one point. They both get top salesmen at one point. But ultimately, what's different about that is that he doesn't want to be there. The ambitions are different. Like, where they want to be is different. And I think they, not only have you got the Michael and Dwight pairing, when you've got Jim and Dwight, is just comedy gold. The pranks are like a subset of the show itself. I'm sure on YouTube they must have done like a supercut of every single prank or something, surely.
I can tell you they do, and the reason I know that is because I've watched them countless times. Just, if I'm ever having a really bad day, if you're ever having a bad day, just stick them on. It's just
okay. That sounds good to me.
It's an instant.
What's your favorite prank?
I mean, I'm a fan of like the long haul crazy stuff that he does. I love the Christmas one where he swaps out his desk and like wraps it all up, and just the payoff where like he goes to sit down and everything just collapses and you're like, how long did that take like to do that? Or I was listening to the Office Ladies the other day, and they talked about the cold open where it's just red wire. It's just a single piece of wire. And Jim knows Dwight so well that Dwight's going to be fixated on this wire. And he goes all over the office, like right the way to his outside climbing a telephone pole just to see where this piece of wire goes. And like Jim clearly got in early and just taped it everywhere. Yeah. I love that. I love the commitment.
The more that the pranks get personal, the better that they are. Because as the series goes on and the writers know their characters more, they know what Jim would know. In what would wind Dwight up. These aren't random. This isn't random stuff. It's stuff that would get on his nerves. My favorites are when you describe long haul stuff is the fax machine thing or like the email thing. I can't remember when he says it's from it's future Dwight and like the orange juice and he knocks it out of the coffee or something and he knocks it out of his hand because it's got poison in. But my absolute favorite prank has got to be Asian Jim.
That's incredible. Again, and like when it's that bit at the end when he picks up the family picture and he's just like the commitment to have because that done.
You honestly expect, you're like, oh, you know, this is hilarious, but clearly like it's not gonna work. Like he's not gonna actually prank Dwight with someone else pretending to be Jim. And then you think as soon as he picks up the photo when he gets so frustrated and he's like, this is Jim, and you look and it's the guy that's replaced him is in the photo as well. You go, it's just that moment, that punchline, it hits so well.
I'm pretty sure that even the kids are Asian as well. Like,
they are.
It's like that extra layer of detail and it just completely destroys Dwight's
and
mind.
And Pam's commitment
time to
the bit as well when she starts to get involved in them is wonderful. So,
They're so good. And again, there's so many, but it's just incredible. When he dresses up as Dwight is another favorite of mine. Again, just like the haircut and the mannerisms and just
That's where Bears Beat Battlestar Galactica comes in.
Identity theft is not a joke. You know?
Question: what kind of bear is best?
That's a ridiculous question.
False. Black bear.
Well, that's debatable. There are basically two schools of thought.
Fact. Bears eat beets. Oh. Bears. Beets. Battlestar Galactica.
Bears do not... What is going on? What are you doing?
Last week, I was in a drugstore and I saw these glasses, $4. And it only cost me $7 to recreate the rest of the ensemble, and that's a grand total of $11.
You know what? Imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, so I thank you. Identity theft is not a joke, Jim. Millions of families suffer every year. Michael! Oh, that's funny. Michael!
Yeah, it's just brilliant. And that's, I think they knew that that was a formula that was working well. And it's great because it's one that switches up all the time. It's not repetitive. It's not, because it could have got old really quickly.
Yeah.
But they were so inventive with it. It's just so much fun.
And something that John Krasinski said in an interview that I thought was really interesting is that they don't come from an angle of like bullying. You know, it's more like there's a sort of like a respect, or like it's like, I mean, maybe this is just me justifying my own behavior, but this is the kind of thing I do to my mates and they've done to me. And like, it's when you're friends with somebody and you know what's going to wind them up, you kind of have to. And so I don't think this would have worked if it had like really upset Dwight, you know, if otherwise we as an audience would feel bad. But you know, the fact that I think there's a little bit of Dwight that kind of enjoys.
Oh, I agree. Because I think without them saying it, and I don't think they ever actually did sort of imply this at all, but my understanding of it is, you know, you only do that with your friends. And so Dwight, you know, unconsciously or consciously must have felt like he had a friend, because, you know, that's what friends do. Exactly. Which is a really sweet sort of way to look at it, because I know there's a lot of the internet that does not like Jim Halpert.
Really? Go on. Do tell me more.
So you know, with Friends, we had the whole, well, actually, Ross is a horrible person because does X, Y, and Z.
Right.
They've set their sights on Jim now, the internet. So the people that have rewatched Friends have seen it through a lens of maybe they're slightly younger and they've got different worldview. Same things happen to The Office, where everyone's watching it for the first time. They haven't watched it. It's from a different time, etc. They're basically like, he's a slacker. He bullies Dwight. He, you know, the whole thing with Pam, like he doesn't tell her that he invested in the company and everything. They nitpick it to hell in terms of, you know, him not being a very good person, him and Pam being a horrible couple. And I'm like, do you know what? You're wrong. You're entitled to your opinion, even if it's wrong. But you know, everyone sort of watches these things and has their own perception of it. And I understand that. I understand if you want to look at it critically about if these people were real, would they be assholes? But that's the thing, they're not real. It's a TV show, so I don't care.
and not everyone can or should be perfect. And that's a credit, I think, to this show. I mean, especially you talk about Jim. Yeah, he's the likable romantic lead of the show, but he doesn't get things right all the time, you know? And I think what's to the credit of the later seasons, even though, you know, sadly, Steve Carell leaves the show, and the show does lose momentum without Michael Scott, of course, but it does very well in keeping the dynamic with Jim and Pam very much alive. And it throws real world problems at them and at their marriage. And Jim makes some bad decisions. Pam makes some bad decisions. But that's real life. That's what happens in relationships. Sometimes people get things wrong. And I think part of what makes Jim actually a really good character and so likable is that, you know, when things are pointed out to him, he does eventually take it on board. And I don't know about you, but like a real standout moment to me, and towards the end of, I think it's the last season, season 9, is when like this whole new business that he's started up is putting a real strain on the marriage. And there's a moment where like he's going to head off again to another meeting, and he just leaps out of a cab and like runs up to Pam and hugs her. And there's this really long pause where she's just kind of stood there, and you can see like her, it's a brilliant bit of acting by both of them. Like she's just sort of taking in everything. And then like, and you as an audience, and I, every time I hold my breath and I'm just like, hug him back. You know, it's because it's
I need like to see that you're going to hug him back.
Exactly. When she does, you're like, oh, thank God. Okay. Mum and dad are okay. They're not splitting up.
But you're right. Cause it's that reflection of, you know, this is how relationships are in real life. You know, there are those struggles and stuff, and there are those things where you can see the cogs wearing in their head. You can see them working this stuff out. It's not a case. It is very different in a sitcom in that sense, because it does become a little bit more of a drama in that way, because there's so much more to the people's decisions. And I am going to compare it to something like Friends, where it does seem a lot more action surfaceable, all for the laughs.
Yeah.
And this is it's a lot more, this is, you know, real stuff, and these are real problems that people have, and, you know, everyone sort of had fights with their partner, and the partner maybe is hugged them, and you are sort of like, I don't know where I am right now. And you can see that all happen through that action, as you say, it's so well acted. But yeah, I think that's what works so well with Jim and Pam, because obviously we've got another will they won't they in here for the first few seasons, which I think is the best will they won't they that I've ever seen, because it's like that they are such good friends. But I think what they do well here, given that they do keep them as a couple, I think we spoke about before about on Friends with Ross and Rachel, is that they clearly didn't have the story there to kind of keep us invested as them as a couple. They kind of threw in stuff that would rock the boat with them for the drama, for the comedy and everything. Whereas here, it's very much like if an office relationship happened and it worked, what would actually happen? And I think that's why it works so well in that. For me, it works because it's more realistic, and other people are kind of like, it's not what I'm used to. I'm used to either people breaking up or they're then the happily married, and often, you know, we don't focus on them anymore. It carries on focusing on them as a couple, just on the after bit, the happily ever after bit that we don't tend to see much, because it's not happily ever after. And there are these things that happen with them. And maybe some people don't really care for that, because it's not a typical trope and it's not something that they can easily watch or be invested in. But I think that that's what they do so well, especially as you say, when Michael Scott leaves, they've built up the character so much to that point where, no, it's not the same. And I would argue that, you know, the best seasons are with Michael. But ultimately, they've created such great characters that life does go on as it does in an office, as it does in a job. And it's that weird thing of you spend every day with these people. They are your life. And then all of a sudden, someone leaves and goes to another job and you just don't ever see them much anymore. So I think it captures that weird bittersweetness of that really well, in that, you know, life goes on in this office and these people and relationships continue even when that person isn't there.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think it was Stephen Merchant, I believe, was the one who said to a lot of the guys involved early on that, like, one of the keys to making this work, because if anyone doesn't know, he and Ricky Gervais were involved, you know, in setting this up. But, like, they both believe that, like, one of the keys to making this work as an adaptation was the Jim Pam storyline. They're like, your central romance has to be believable, and you have to invest in it, and you've just got to look after it. And again, I highly encourage people to listen to interviews with all of them, because you can really hear how much particularly John Krasinski and Jenna Fischer really cared about the romance of these two characters and the relationship. And as you say, throughout the whole show, well, whatever point these characters were in, whether they were, you know, in that will they won't they sort of desperate, frustrating stage, or whether they were dating, or whether they were getting married, or the kids, or whatever's going on, at every cut and turn, they, as actors, and same with the writers and everyone, was so invested in making it as believable as possible. And I think you're right. I think, to me, it's one of the best TV relationships you see on screen, and they sell that friendship so much to the point that when you find out they're not together in real life, it's kind of a bit disappointing.
I was heartbroken. I was like, what do you mean this isn't real?
Yeah, this is it. Like, because it's so believable that you're like, wait, what? But still, I mean, it's just a testament to them as actors. And
absolutely.
And it's one of those romances that I think is really interesting, because, as you say, Jim's a very sort of, he's a nice, charming guy. He's kind of funny and a little bit charismatic, but he's very middle of the road kind of guy. Like you said, he's not got any crazy ambitions or anything like that. And the character of Pam, the way she's played and written, is a very ordinary person. But again, I think it makes it all the more relatable as an audience member if you're watching it.
Absolutely. Because you've got the Michael and the Dwight. And even Meredith. And oh my god, I can't even remember what the older guy's called. That's really bad.
Maybe Stanley or Kevin?
No.
Or Creed. Oh, Creed's Creed. Another level. Like, Creed is another level.
They are wacky, and they are very clearly their own characters.
For sure.
But the Jim and the Pam are the characters that you can put yourself in to experience the other people, I think.
Yes.
They obviously grow to have their own personalities and everything, but they are designed in such a way, I think, that they are the characters in which you then experience the rest of The Office, which is probably why the way the relationship is done so well as well, and it's treated with such care, it works so well in that way, because it's done with characters that aren't I'm watching Ross and Rachel, I'm watching Leslie and Ben. It's kind of like you are watching Jim and Pam, but you can feel it as if like that was to kind of happen to you as well in a different way than you would watching other TV shows, I think.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of the stuff they give them, particularly in the early seasons, where it takes them up to, I think it's season 4 before they start officially dating. None of that feels contrived. I don't know about you, like when you look back over it, a lot of the obstacles and the things they put in the way make sense, and as you say, you can see it happening in real life. You're like, oh yeah, that would I mean, for one thing, Pam's engaged for like 2 seasons, so like, well, that's a huge obstacle right there, and then Jim moves away and he meets another woman, and like things like that do happen, and people sort of,
and it's all, you know, they're all cross over, as you say, that they're not contrived, because the reason Jim wants to move is because Pam's engaged. So it's like, it's not all of a sudden they were so close to being together and now he's gone. Like, it all ladders up to, what would that person, if you were in love with someone that you work with and they're engaged and this job opportunity came up, what would you do? And that's exactly, he explains that in the talking head. And, you know, you can, the great thing about the talking head sort of setup is that you do get that chance to hear what they're thinking. However, it's done from a place of, what would you say to a camera crew? Not what are they actually thinking, which is the beauty of it, because you can see people lie to themselves and the camera when Jenna, I keep calling her Jenna because it's Jenna Fisher, but when Pam is talking about Jim moving away or I can't remember why they weren't sort of seeing each other, she has tears in her eyes when she's like, but it's okay, it's fine, we don't have to, you know, it wasn't meant to be. And then Jim comes through the door and he bursts through the door and is like, oh, do you want to, like, let's go on a date, whatever, and she turns around and her eyes are like filled with tears, but she's so happy, like, that's just like one of my favorite scenes from the whole of the show.
That is definitely in the top 10, and it's, I'm pretty sure that's how season 3 ends. It's such a great moment just to end the show, end that series on.
I think I gasped the first time I watched it when he came
you either gasp or you're like, leap out of your chair like, yes! Finally, you
know? Right.
Dunder Mifflin, this is Pam. Just one moment, I'll transfer you. I haven't heard anything, but I bet Jim got the job. I mean, why wouldn't he? He's totally qualified and smart. Everyone loves him. And if he never comes back again, that's okay. We're friends, and I'm sure we'll stay friends. We never got the timing right, you know? I shot him down and then he did the same to me. But you know what? It's okay. I'm totally fine. Everything is going to be totally
fine. Sorry. Are you free for dinner tonight?
Yes.
All right. Then it's a date.
Sorry, what was the question?
And I think, like you say, a lot of that comes down to how Jenna Fisher plays Pam as well as the other half of that relationship. Like, she's such a lovely character, and you know, you totally understand why they work as a couple. And yeah, it's, I think she plays that with such a level of vulnerability, I think, as a character, you know, like when you first meet her, she's been engaged to the same man for, I think, I can't remember how many years it is, but it's a long ass time to be engaged to somebody. And
maybe like four or five, something like that,
you know, and you get the sense she's not happy in her job. So she's someone who's stuck in a rut, and she's got this one little light in her day, which is her friendship with Jim, you know, and that's like such a lovely place to like build off a relationship.
Definitely. Absolutely. And then you look to when, you know, I think it's before they start seeing each other again, because she's in that place of, she broke it off with Roy, but then Jim wasn't available. And when they go, they do the beach away day and she runs across the hot coals.
Yeah. Great. That's
such a huge character moment for her, because she's such a lovely person. She does withdraw herself and doesn't speak up for what she needs. And so seeing that moment where she kind of just goes out there and does something, and you can see the exhilaration in her, and that's a real changing point for her character, I think. And that's, again, such a great scene.
Totally. And I want to know, what do you think of her arc where she goes to art school and then sort of comes back? Because I could see that's another thing that some people might have an issue with.
Yeah, I think it... As much as I would have loved to have seen it, I think particularly as a female character, because it is a shame that it kind of is perpetuated as she doesn't get to fulfill her dreams because she's a mum. Mm. I don't know if that was on purpose or it was an oversight in that actually it would have been really great if she got to explore that. But also it's like, can we really place all of that responsibility on a show doing that just because all the other shows haven't?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like if that's not what the character, what would happen to the character, I think that's what's so important with these shows, is what actually would happen to the character. Obviously you can kind of set external things up as challenges, but ultimately the reason that film and TV works so well, stuff like Game of Thrones before the end, which is based on a book, obviously it's different, but like, because the way that it was, I've heard people explain that the way that it was done is the characters moved like chess pieces. They weren't thrown across the board to, oh, now we're going to do this and now we're going to do that. And I think maybe this is a case of, well, the way that it works out is that this just wouldn't work for her. And maybe that's a really interesting way to look back at, well, sometimes things don't work out in life. And maybe it's a bit more of a realistic take on, you know, you've got Leslie Knope from Parks and Rec, who achieves like consistently every season she gets something done, and that's her character. She wouldn't settle for anything less, whereas Pam's always been, if she isn't been sort of just taking things because she feels like she has to, once she moves past that, she is just content with her small life. So it's interesting, I guess, actually, to explore a different route of, you know, people do have dreams, but sometimes they're happy to, and I think she says that in the talking head about, you know, dreams are great, but, you know, we've got everything that we need. And there's another point where, you know, Jim's doing his whole thing and they're sort of in a bit of contention, and she has the notebook and it has the two lists where it's like, what matters, what doesn't.
What matters,
Pam, Cece, the new baby, what doesn't, everything else. And I think what makes them work as characters is they both have that view of they have everything they need. Anything else is just a bonus. I think that's quite sweet.
It is. And I mean, I think back to how the sort of final season wraps up, in that she's worried that, I think she says, you know, I'm worried I'm not enough for you, which I think is such a human emotion. I think all of us can feel that insecure in a relationship at times.
Absolutely.
And of course, Jim's response is to prove her wrong with, you know, what he does best, which is, you know, great gestures. And it's just a nice reminder to her and to us as an audience, you know, where it all began, and like how, why he is who he is and how he's ended up where he is because of her. And so it's like, look, even if you're not this big successful artist or whatever, it's like, that doesn't matter, you know, and like he gives up a business, you know, because of what's more important. And so, yeah, you're right. I agree with you. I think more often than not, a lot of shows and sitcoms in particular can be quite guilty of setting up characters to, you know, ride off in the sunset and all their dreams and hopes were fulfilled, and that can be really nice, and I'm not criticizing that all the time, but as coming back to what we were saying at the start, really, that the whole setup, the whole premise of this show is a slice of real life, Yeah. And in real life,
it's the ordinary. It doesn't always happen. It's the ordinary with a little bit of extraordinary with the likes of Michael and Dwight and everything. But ultimately, yeah, things like, for example, with Modern Family, when it sort of got towards the later seasons, and I know that they all are very privileged families, like they make that very clear. You know, I don't know if you've seen it, but like Claire, who is the mum of the main family, goes back to work. She ends up being the CEO of her dad's company. She then decides to quit and go into, and it's just all too easy, even for privileged people. There's just no time spent on any kind of struggle.
Right.
And you know what? That's their formula, and that's, you know, that's not why I watched that show. But I think in comparison, it's just, this is very much, you know, the ordinary, looking at the little joys in life rather than the big stuff, which is a nice sort of sentiment to have when you're watching a TV show, for sure.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I mean, speaking of other female leads and characters, if we're talking about Jenna Fisher as Pam, I think we have to talk about her best friend in real life. The one and only Angela Kinsey, who plays Angela Martin.
I can't believe we haven't mentioned Angela yet, actually.
Yeah, well, of course, there's her and Dwight and that whole saga. I mean, I think she's incredible, and I'm so glad that she's initially a bit of a background character, but like her, you know, Brian Baumgartner as Kevin Malone, and I've lost him, where is he, Oscar Nunez as Oscar Martinez, that little accountant's corner, I'm so glad that they get to branch out a bit more as the show goes on, because they're so funny.
They are a little bit like the Three Stooges, a little bit in a sense of like, like, although Kevin clearly is the archetype of dumb one, they all have their moments where it's just like, what is going on between you? They have their own sagas, like, obviously when you move later on to Angela with her, the senator cheating on her and being gay. Then, he can move in with Oscar and like that whole thing. But it's I don't know, like, I think because you've built up, they took the time with these characters, and they had all these background characters, and sometimes you start the series and you're like, who the hell is that in the background? Like, this isn't a character. But ultimately it's like they focused on the main guys first, and then they realized what worked well, and they started to bring in new sort of like players and start playing them off towards everyone until they kind of got a rhythm with it. And yeah, they tend to have their own little B stories between these three, or like different combinations of them. And I just can see their little Alex in the corner like so perfectly. And I just love the fact that so many of their jokes are actually related to accounting as well. And the fact of like, if Kevin does something wrong, or the fact that Oscar is so like adamant that he's right all the time, and like obviously Angela, so it's just great the little details they go into, because at the end of the day, if you've ever worked in an office, you have had to work with the finance department, so it's always quite funny to see that sort of represented in that way.
Totally. I mean, I think apparently they had their own little mini web series sort of back in the day when TV shows used to do that. Yeah, I learned this listening to the Office Ladies show, that apparently they had a little accountant show, and it won an award. So like, again, I think that was another reason why the writers started to include them more, because all three of them have a background in either acting or comedy and improv. So again, it's that thing of like, as you say, rather than go, oh, hang on, we've got these background characters, but they're also all incredibly talented and funny. Like, let's bring them forward.
Give them moments to shine.
And I mean, to pick up Angela and pair her with someone like Dwight, it makes total sense the more you think about it, you know?
Yeah, it really does. And I think it's just like, it's one of those ones, I guess, it has to grow on you a little bit. And I think it's just because they're such specific personalities that you like, you think, oh, this can't work. But actually their values and their sensibilities are so similar. That you're like, well, yeah, of course, why wouldn't they work together? And it's just like, it's funny to see how their relationship develops. Like when they get to the point where they, I can't remember why, but they have a contract of like how many times Dwight then has to sleep with Angela. And I can't remember why
it's to procreate, to bear a child.
To procreate, using the official language that they would be using. But the thing that pops to mind is like, I think she does it, and she knows that Dwight just wants to sleep with her anyway. And then I think he kind of loses interest for some reason. And she doesn't like that. So she goes out to her car And she gets changed into like a checkered shirt and jeans.
Yeah.
She wants to like seem sexy to him, and that's what would be sexy to Dwight. And he's like, oh, what are you wearing? And she's like, oh, just had to throw like my gardening clothes on. And it's just like, it's funny seeing these sort of typical sitcom-y situations of how these characters would act in, you know, trying to make someone jealous and things like that, but in such a specific way to their personalities. It just makes me laugh so much.
Yeah, that specificity is just that's in all of the characters. And yeah, and like, I just, the whole thing, I get, we're talking about reasons, you know, why there's troubles with some of these relationships. And I think Dwight and Angela have like one of the most incredible reasons to break up, and that is that Dwight kills her very, very sick cat. And like,
yeah,
in any other show, that would be the most contrived nonsense you've ever seen.
Yeah, you're right, actually.
But
it
makes sense, because you know both of these characters. Like, as soon as Angela starts
It's earned, because
it's so earned. I mean,
characters care about and how they would act in those situations, because you know that Dwight was, I say, doing the right thing, not, but that is how he would handle that situation. And he doesn't think there's anything wrong with that.
And it's like the second Angela starts talking about the cat, you just see like that look on his face, and you're like, oh no, like he's not listening to any of these instructions. Like he's, like you said, he knows how to handle this as a farmer, and that's what he's gonna do. And like, you just see it in that like split second, and it and it makes sense, because then you're like, well, of course that's gonna really upset Angela, because she's a crazy cat lady. You know, like she cleans her cats at one point. Like, we see that.
Oh my god, she licks them, doesn't she?
She licks a cat, and it's such a disturbing but really funny moment. And I mean, one of my favorite quotes of the entire show: "Save Bandit." You know, like she brings a cat to work, and then during the chaos of that fire escape, just throws it through the ceiling. And it never fails to make me laugh. But yeah, again, but it makes sense again. Like at that point, after like five seasons with that character, when she pulls the cat out of the drawer, you just go, yeah, of course she's got one in the drawer. Yeah. Of course. And of course, that's what she thinks of.
Yeah, like, we obviously only see these characters, and more so outside of the office as you sort of go along and when it serves the story. But ultimately, you see their work personas. So actually, the reason it is quite fun and it works quite well is that you get these little moments where the door to their personal life kind of opens a little bit and becomes a bit ajar, and you learn something about them. And yeah, it just makes it all the more fun to learn about, not know everything about this character, then every now and then it's like, I mean, Creed is an obvious one that you know nothing about this guy, and he comes out with the most crazy stuff. But like, even like Kevin's chili, and he's like, oh, it's my famous chili, I cook it every year or something, and you're like, this is amazing that he has this, and that's part of his persona and life and whatever, and then it's just played for a laugh because he spills it everywhere.
Yeah, that's
it's
like
just great.
Oh, that's the most tragic cold open, isn't it? Every time he's just like just swimming in it, and you're just like,
it's literally
no.
Like burnt into my brain, that image of him just like it tipping over.
Yeah, and again, I think that character, you get more and more. I think the first season you meet him, it's a very kind of plain, he's based off of I've blanked on the guy's name. I'm pretty sure it's Kevin as well, in the British office, where he's like very plain,
something like Keith or something.
Keith. I talked about him, yeah, because Keith is like this really dull, plain character, and Kevin is obviously a rip on that. But again, as the show goes, I love that even simple stuff like how he talks, like you notice in the first few seasons he's really monotone and he talks like this. And then as the show goes on, Brian Baumgartner just brings like his level of animation to him. He talks like a Muppets character. He's like.
Well, they say, don't they? They put it.
Yeah, he's like the Cookie Monster.
And it's so true. And even like when he does that bit where he's like, I've decided to stop using so many words, and he starts talking like a caveman.
Yeah,
that's funny.
Me save really time. Funny. Yeah. And you're like.
And it's just like, it's so, when you think about the fact that there is a storyline about the fact that an office worker decides to cut out words, you're like, how is this entertaining? How is this funny? And it just goes to show it's the scale of stuff and how it relates to that specific character that makes it work so well.
Me mechanic not speak English, but he know what me mean when me say car no go, and we best friends. So me think, why waste time? Say lot word when few word do trick.
Kevin, I appreciate what you're trying to do.
Thank.
Here, we have a word code, the same way we have a dress code. And what we're talking about is basically the speech equivalent to just wearing underpants. Sometimes words you know need use, but need for talk.
But save time, more success.
Does it save time though? Because we've been here for about an hour.
No me fault.
Kevin, at most you're saving a microscopic amount of time.
Many small time make big time.
And what are you gonna do with all this time?
See world.
Kevin, you can't possibly save enough time to see the world.
Kevin, are you saying see the world or sea world?
Sea world. Oceans, fish, jump,
okay.
China.
No, see, right there, that's the problem with your method, because I still don't know if you're saying sea world or see the world, and it's taken a lot of time to explain it.
Fine, I'll talk normally. When me president, they see. They see.
Yeah, and you talk about images burned into the brain. One of mine permanently is when Michael Scott tries to force Kevin to eat a piece of broccoli, and he just like shoves it in. I just like the face that Kevin pulls, like the tears rolling down his cheek. It's so it's so visceral, but it's so funny.
Yeah,
and again, you're like, brilliant. What is going on right now? What is happening?
I think, I think for me, the main image that will always be burnt into my brain is Dwight turning around during the first aid episode, having the CPR dummy's face as a mask and pretending to be Hannibal Lecter, which is just like the absolute peak of that scene, by the way, which just
is so
exponential
good.
In its chaos. And I just think that is my favorite scene and episode out of the whole thing, I think. It's just that layers upon layers of chaos per character of what they are doing. Yes. And it's just, even just like when Creed is like, oh, I saw you in the parking lot earlier. That's how I know you.
Yes.
Stupid. It's so dumb, but that's his character and it just works so well.
Yeah. I mean, and Creed's a great example. Like, I don't know if you know this about him, but he's basically more or less himself. Like, Creed Bratton is a person. He's a blues musician. And a really good one. I'm actually going to see him next year at a live show.
Way.
I'm so excited. But he's really good. And yeah, like you said, he was one of those who was just an extra initially.
Yeah.
And then I think it was the episode where Michael has to fire someone, and it's either him or another guy. And that's when they realized how funny Creed could be, because he just would just go crazy and improvise and do all sorts of stuff. And they were like, we've got to keep this guy in. And like, he apparently used to make it his mission on the show to just break a lot of other people. And there's one of his best lines. And apparently it's, if you can find the outtakes on YouTube, the one that absolutely broke John Krasinski was like where Creed tells a story and then Jim just goes, pretty sure that didn't happen. You're like, pretty sure that's not real. And then Creed just turns around. It's like, you're not real, man. And then just storms off. And like, there's like a 10 minutes of just him doing that over and over. And then John is just dead.
How did these people keep a straight face? How
they don't.
Straight face when this stuff. They must do it. They must have to do so many takes all the time.
Hey, where's Dwight?
You didn't hear? Decapitated. Whole big thing. We had a funeral for a bird.
I'm pretty sure none of that's real.
You're not real, man.
They must, again, I highly encourage people to listen to the Office Ladies in particular is really good, because they do it obviously episode by episode. And they always talk about moments where, like, you can see the camera has to pan away from somebody because they're about to break. And it's like,
I suppose
the 20th
that's what's
take.
Great about the setup, right? The fact that it's a documentary, they can be quite fluid with how they shoot things. And
exactly.
Because I imagine they must all be in hysterics all day, every day.
Can you imagine being in the little pen when Steve Carell comes out and does Prison Mike and just getting through that without dying? I couldn't do it. I'd like, you have to cut me out of the scene, because I would just be bowled over laughing every time.
There's somebody I'd like you to meet. Somebody else who has been to prison, who can tell you what it is really like. I'm Prison Mike! You know why they call me Prison Mike?
Do you really expect us to believe you're somebody else?
Do you really expect me to not push you up against the wall, bitch?
Okay. Yes.
All right, hey, that's just the way we talk in the clink. Been a lot of fun talk about prison today, but I am here to scare you straight. I am here to scare you straight! In prison, you are somebody's bitch. Oh, and you, my friend, would be the belle of the ball. Don't drop the soap. Don't drop the soap.
Michael, please. Where did you learn all of this?
Internet.
So not prison.
And prison. It's 50-50. Both.
Yeah, it's too much. It's too much. I just want to watch it all again now.
I know, like, I know. Oh. This is it. And all, I mean, all of them. I mean, it gets, you talk about the smaller characters. Stanley Hudson, Leslie David Baker plays to an absolute T.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has some of like the best kind of deadpan humor of the whole show.
Yeah.
And, that, like,
and when
yeah.
he's talking to Ryan and he's like, have you lost your mind? Because I'll help you find it.
You're going to find it, boy. Yeah. Jesus will help you find it.
Yeah, just brilliant. Yeah, no, he's great. Phyllis as well.
Oh yeah, Phyllis is another one. Like she wasn't an actress before this. She was in.
Oh.
I learned apparently she was in casting.
Oh, and, interesting.
Yeah, and she was offered a role again as like an extra, and she was quite nervous about it. And they were like, you know, just fine. You turn up, take a desk, and you know, you can just sort of pretend you're doing work.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, it's like as the show went on, like they found she could be quite funny and dry and. I mean, I love her and Bob Vance from Vance Refrigeration.
Yeah.
Is like
one of, thank talk, you for saying about, his full name.
Well, of course, you have to. You have to. Yeah. And their whole relationship is hilarious. The fact that they're basically
funny,
a couple of horny teenagers, like when you get
when
to know them.
When they go for dinner with Jim and Pam and they're gone for like... Oh, it's
so fun. Yeah, like, where have they been? And they both come back looking a little disheveled. You're like, oh...
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think there's a character that I don't like in this, to be honest. They all have all have such great moments, especially the, like the more sort of, I wouldn't say cameos because they're probably in there for quite a few seasons. But I think what they try to do when Michael goes is to have these moments with certain characters that can kind of bring that wackiness or that sort of authority figure and different kinds of authority. So they have Will Ferrell in for like one or two episodes. They have Idris Elba. They have what is the guy that
James
played Robert
Spader.
California?
James Spader.
Oh my god. Do you know what? I've got like a newfound love for Robert California now after watching
the last few times
because he used to creep me out so much. But that's what his appeal is, right? Is that you think he's this like big, like amazing, like business person that knows exactly what he's doing. No, he's just like weaseled his way in somehow because he's just so out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've seen it, but obviously he voices Ultron in the MCU.
Have I seen it? Hang on. Have I seen it? My witness my Funko Pops.
Well, what I was going to say is if you've seen that they've done a YouTube video where they have layered Robert California quotes over sections of video of Ultron.
I'm literally typing this into Google as we speak.
I just die every single time. They do it in a way that it makes sense in the scene because obviously Ultron is like a huge monologuer and so is Robert California. And they pick things up where Ultron is just walking around going, I don't care much for the Black Eyed Peas. It's just the funniest thing because you just, all of the Avengers are sitting there looking horrified while he's just going, they're pop for people who don't like pop.
Literally,
you're gonna love it.
I've just put that on my watch later list on YouTube.
You're gonna love it.
As soon as we have done here, I'm watching that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I'm so glad you say that because I find like, of course, that's a tricky point in the series, right? Where Steve Carell's gone, and like we said, there's this huge vacuum. Michael Scott's gone, and the show, you know, a lot of the execs basically wanted another leading man, another wacky boss. And this is where it kind of gets divided for a lot of people, but I'm with you. From day one, when they brought in James Spader, I was like, mm-hmm. oh yes, this is going to be something else.
Yeah.
And it works because he brings a kind of, you know, where Michael's kind of got this wacky antics thing going on. James Spader is a very serious actor, so he comes at it from a straight man point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously every now and then they'll give him like random bizarre dialogue. But because he's doing the straight man thing, it's so good. Yeah, it's so good.
Like, I don't know how to describe it, but he just like holds on to it in terms mm-hmm. of this weirdness and yes. just pushes it to the limit. You know, it's just, and it's so funny to see the way the characters react because,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
this guy is uncomfortable to be around. And like, yeah. how would you as someone who's, that's your new boss, react in that situation? Because obviously Michael Scott was such a unique character that it became, you know, you probably wouldn't have a boss like that,
sure,
but you probably could have a bit of a creepy boss who starts talking about these things and you're like, what?
Yeah,
what is going on?
You are a man of great confidence. Could you speak a little more to that and what the role of confidence would be in a dialogue with a support?
Will you be heard? Will you have a voice? Will I steamroll over you? Do you feel heard right now, Jim? Do you have a voice right now? You can answer me.
Yeah.
That was your choice, not mine. The fallacy is that it is up to the steamroller. It is up to the object whether it will be flattened or not. And I can tell just from the small interaction we've had already, you won't be flattened by anybody. Do you agree with me, Jim?
Yes.
Yes, you do.
He creeps me out. But I think he might be a genius.
It was really interesting that you know, it was such a huge void to fill, and I think they did the right thing by not trying to pick one person to then become the new Michael Scott. What was amazing about it is obviously it had done so well up until that point in the US that they were able to attach such amazing talent to come in and do these seasons or moments. You know, you had Catherine Tate and Kathy Bates, yeah. and as I said, Will Ferrell and Idris Elba and stuff come in for their own little bits, and they're all so different.
Yeah.
That whilst I think the series becomes two halves in that you've got the half of Michael Scott and you've got yes. the half without. You know, Michael Scott is for me The Office, but you know, there's still so much fun to be had in those later seasons with all the Catherine Tate as well. I don't know if I said that. So
absolutely,
yeah, there's just a lot of fun to be sort of squeezed out of all these different new characters that they bring in.
Yeah, this is it. And you know, something else as well, even when they pass on the kind of the final seasons, they pass on the sort of boss role to Ed Helms as Andy Bernard. I think that's probably for me where it starts to peter out a bit. But in the show's defense, I think they were winding down. You know, like, again, mm-hmm. you listen to a lot of the people behind the scenes. They didn't want to go beyond season 9. So you get that sense.
And I think
sense.
They were maybe playing on the Hangover success with Ed Helms as well, maybe. Yeah,
for sure.
And I unfortunately, it doesn't work for me personally because he just becomes a massive and that's just not what that character was, which is such a shame because he was something unique. He was something unique in that, you know, with the whole musical thing and the try hard thing, you know, it was similar in some ways to some other characters, but it was enough for him to be a unique character. And he is a great actor as well in that way that he definitely sort of carved his own spot, but I don't think it was the kind of character to have in the forefront at all.
Yes. I agree. Yeah, for sure. He's a good support role in the ensemble, but yeah, you're right. That's for me when it was like, they're starting to change the character a bit here. You know, like you said, he becomes really horrible, and you're like, that's not Andy. Andy's naive and privileged. He's not mean spirited. You know, so.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it winds down for him in the end, and I think his introduction is great. I love that Jim, you know, immediately his instinct is, you know, oh, I found another Dwight. And then quickly realizes, yeah. Oh, no, I don't. This guy's unhinged.
Yeah.
That's a great moment, I think, you know, just instantly him freaking out and like kicking dustbins around. And you're like, oh, OK, yeah. This guy's got an edge.
Yeah, for sure. Ticking time bomb.
OK. Who put my calculator in Jell-O? Good one. Seriously, guys. I need to know who put my calculator in Jell-O. Or I'm gonna lose my freaking mind.
I think if they'd have played on that a little bit more at the beginning,
yeah,
that could have been interesting enough for when he then obviously became a little bit more of a main role and he kind of went off the edge. It would all make more sense. But I think, as you say, they made him such a naive kind of place of privilege, but ultimately sort of well-meaning guy. He wasn't filled in enough, I don't think, before he sort of was ushered into a bigger role. And that's why it does make me think, and I've spoken about, people have mentioned this to me before I even recognized that it might have been to do with the success of Hangover, that
I think you're right. Yeah.
They kind of shooed him into a bigger role there.
Yeah. I mean, and to be fair, like, you get to that point at the end of the show. I mean, all of them have achieved pretty big success by the end of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like you said, if you had to pick somebody, I can kind of understand why they did it, but I agree with you. I think that's probably the weaker part of that final season, is the stuff with him doesn't work as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I still think it's funny. The character's still great. And like you said, Ed Helms brings some interesting points to it. I do love the episode where he's in a musical of Sweeney Todd. I think that's really good.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
When he brings in the performers into the office, they start performing. Yeah. When I found out, one of my good friends that I work with, she was doing Sweeney Todd literally just the second week that I joined the agency, and I went to go and see her because there was a spare ticket. And it just always reminds me of her when I watch that bit now. And I sent her the link and I was like, are you going to do this in the office? Please, please bring your troop into the office. But yeah, no, that's brilliant. So, and that works because it makes sense for his character. You know, he has the singing stuff and he's always full of such passion for the performing side of things. And obviously he likes Erin, and that kind of gets, that's his sort of story in that moment of wanting her to be there and things like that. And I think, yeah, no, that's fun for sure. Yeah. It makes me chuckle.
I do think it's a shame though, like you said, the relationship with him and Erin, played by Ellie Kemper, kind of dies off towards the end, because like those early bits where you see them in I think it's like season 6, she comes in. You feel like they do very well at playing off each other, and there's that kind of lovely chemistry of two very naive, almost like childlike people getting together. So again, it's kind of a shame that peters off at the end, but I think those few seasons, it's worth
watching. He had to go, didn't he? I wonder if he had other obligations for filming.
I think so.
And then that's why he had to go away. And that always does, unfortunately, throw a spanner in the works for how to write these people into the story out. And, you know, he was still a character in it, so they couldn't do anything definite. And it is a tricky situation. And I don't think that they handled it badly. But as you say, I think it's just the later seasons aren't quite to the sort of heights of the first, or I would say the mid seasons.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But it's something that's a positive, I think, about the show, and I think is really intelligent. I don't know many other shows did it before, was they introduced some writers in as actors. So for anyone who doesn't know this, Mindy Kaling, BJ Novak, and Paul Lieberstein, so that's Kelly Kapoor, Ryan Howard, and Toby Flenderson, respectively, were all writers on the show.
How have we not mentioned them yet?
I know. Right?
Too many good characters.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of the other annex, you know, the other side of the office, like those guys tucked away. But really, really smart move, I think, mixing in writers with actors, you know, because it's great. Like you've got them in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And all of them are absolutely wonderful. You know, all those characters, I think, are hilarious. I mean, the destructive relationship between Kelly and Ryan is just incredible. It's so toxic, but it's so funny.
When he pretends to be her boss and she just lets it happen. She dresses up for him to go into the office and he ignores her, and they say, it's just, don't they steal a baby and run off together at the Dwight's wedding
or something? I think Ryan abandons a baby at the wedding. Just to be with Kelly. Yeah. You're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, no, there's some really great moments with those guys, specifically Woof. When Ryan does Woof, and then it turns out that it was all Kelly's idea anyway. That just kind of summarizes that relationship quite well, doesn't it? But yeah, Toby. Toby is Michael's foil. Just the monotone, like the bits that they do with it, he's giving him therapy are some my favorite bits. Oh, so good.
It's really sad that your dog ran away, but why did it keep you from going to the park?
I was afraid I would find him in the park playing with another kid.
Why?
I guess that's why I thought he ran away in the first place, to find a kid he liked better.
Dogs don't do that.
Right? Why would a dog do that?
That's, I don't know.
When I hear myself say it, it just sounds ridiculous, but I never said it out loud, so.
It's very important for you to be liked, isn't it?
Well, let's not get too, this isn't a counseling session. Okay. You son of a gun. You son of a bitch. Wow. Okay.
Just trying to help you, Michael.
God.
Michael.
You're very helpful, aren't you? You try to help everybody. Do you want to play another game? Are good. But you know what? You can't help people. You couldn't help your marriage. You lose. I don't need your help. Nobody needs your help. Nobody wants it. You can't help anybody. I don't need your help. Am I gonna make you cry?
Just fill them out any way you want.
Okay.
Have Aaron fax them back to corporate.
Will do. Okay, filled out. Good. Thank you, doctor. Take two of these and call me in the morning.
Such a... Oh, yeah. Again, you can listen to them talk about that and just how much fun it was for them to go back and forth in that room. And it was quite interesting. I can't really figure out where or when it happened, but there is a moment where they just, for some reason, they kind of fixate on this idea of, like, Michael Scott is going to hate Toby.
Yeah, you know? And it's just brilliant because there's no explanation other than that he just doesn't like him. And why does there need to be an explanation? Because Michael is a child, and when you're a child, if you hate someone, you don't care about hiding it. You don't need a reason. If they annoy you, he literally says, why are you the way that you are? Because he genuinely wants to know. He doesn't understand why Toby ruins all his fun all the time. He's the boring adult in Michael's child world.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're exactly right. I think that is it, isn't it? He's the voice of reason.
He's the fun police.
He's the guy that comes in and is like, okay, this needs to stop. And yeah, like you said, Michael sees that as the enemy. And that quote is one of my favorite Michael Scott quotes. It's just
so good, isn't it?
It's so mean, but it's so funny. It's just like,
but you can tell as well that, like, as Michael as a character, it was him thinking out loud and not caring. Like, he didn't say it pointedly, he didn't prepare to say it. He just said, why are you the way that you are? So good.
Doesn't he say as well, like, I hate so much about the things that you choose to be, and like just constantly assassinating his character.
It's just brilliant.
He just stands there and takes it.
Exactly. And that's what's so funny about Toby as a character. Like, he's so docile and just doesn't even react in any way whatsoever. But talking quickly about the way Michael sort of delivers his lines, some of my favorite ones are he says, I'm not superstitious, I'm a little stitious. It's one of my favorites. I also like the one which I can't do perfectly, but he says the best advice is, like, always. He just makes it up completely.
He just starts, doesn't he? And he just doesn't know where he's going.
There's a cutaway where he's like, sometimes I don't even know where I'm taking things as I'm saying them. There's so many Michael Scott quotes, but my favorite completely random one that somehow I keep saying all the time is when they give the gift basket to a potential customer and then they go to someone else
Yeah.
And it's got like some chocolate turtles in, and Michael just screams, "Where are the turtles?" It just lives in my mind 24/7, and I just love to say it so much because it's just so ludicrous. Like,
it's been opened.
Yeah, it was mine.
What's missing? The turtles. Where are the summer turtles? Sausage. Where are the turtles?
Come on, guys, get out of here.
Where are the turtles? Where are they?
Excuse me, I have an announcement to make. We seem to be missing a box of turtles, and we will not be leaving the premises until we obtain them. Hand over the turtles now!
Exactly. That. I mean, that's an episode of just descending into chaos. Like you say, it's just him screaming at a man about chocolate turtles.
Brilliant.
My favourite has to be in my personal favourite episode, and I want to know what yours is, of course. For me, my favourite one is the dinner party, I think is one of the finest episodes of comedy.
With Jan?
Yeah. I mean, Jan, played by Melora Harding, is a whole other thing in herself, but it's just a bit where
she sings. It's
when she sings, but my favourite Michael Scott quote is in that episode where he's just talking about the vasectomy, and he's going, snip, snap, snip, snap.
When I said that I wanted to have kids and you said that you wanted me to have a vasectomy, what did I do? And then when you said that you might want to have kids and I wasn't so sure, who had the vasectomy reversed? And then when you said you definitely didn't want to have kids, who had it reversed back? Snip, snap, snip, snap, snip, snap. I did. Okay. You have no idea the physical toll the three vasectomies have on a person.
I love in that episode he's talking about the flat screen TV.
Yeah, and he pulls it out.
And also where he sleeps, which is just like a stool on the bed. And he's like, he curls up. It's just absolutely brilliant. There's just so many Michael Scott quotes.
My goodness.
When he pulls up in the car and he's like, it's Britney, bitch.
Yeah.
Then he's at the top of the building. And they're doing like an awareness day about depression, and he shouts,
"Dwight, you
ignorant slut!" Where did that come from? It's like, I'm sorry. The more we're talking, the more I'm realizing he's just a child who says things he doesn't know what they mean.
No, exactly.
So it's like he's saying it because he likes the way it sounds, but it doesn't make any sense to call Dwight a slut in this scenario.
No, not at all.
But it works perfectly. Yeah.
So much. I mean, even when, like, I just thought back to dinner at date night when the dinner party where Jan says that, like, having like Spanish food, and he just goes, "Well, when in Rome," and just says stuff like that that you're like, yeah, like you said, it makes no sense. And he just kind of he's heard it somewhere, and he's just like, "Oh, I'll keep that," and has no idea.
Yeah, but I mean, like superstitious thing.
Yeah, I'm a little superstitious.
He doesn't
know
what it means.
Or ASAP as possible.
Oh my god, I say that all the time.
Yeah,
as ASAP as possible. I say that all the time. Oh my god, it's just too much. And when another one which is just an absolute classic, and he's like, "I am Beyonce always."
Yeah.
It's just said with such conviction.
So I want to know, do you have a favorite episode than Daisy? It's hard to pick. I know
it is hard to pick, but my mind always goes to the first aid one.
Yeah, that, you know, that is an excellent choice, I think. Yeah, for sure.
And I do think it's unoriginal in my choice, though. I do think it's one of the highest rated episodes of theirs.
But that's still fine. And like what you said earlier, it is just it's an episode that just things keep escalating.
And
it opens on like an absolutely bonkers cold open. You think, how are they going to top this? And it just keeps going.
Yeah, so I think ultimately it's just got to be that, because that's the one I always go back to.
Excellent choice. And I see the gif of Dwight doing the Hannibal Lecter thing all the time, and it never fails to make me laugh.
Whenever there's any CPR in any kind of media, I just think when she goes, "Now do the compressions to the tune of Staying Alive." And then he goes,
First I was afraid
I was petrified. And then when he does eventually get onto the Bee Gees, you've got Kelly dancing in the corner, Andy comes in with the falsetto. Like, it's just a perfect showcase of what each of those characters would do in that situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Yeah.
It's so funny. And yeah, that cold open, I think, is absolutely hilarious. Just like you said, the pushing, the shoving, the screaming. I mean, that's another gif of Michael Scott when he comes out the office and he's like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
nobody panic. It's happening. It's happening. You see that everywhere. That's all over Twitter. And I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many gifs for so many occasions from that show. Oh, a really good cold open as well, which is just not even much for laughs, but just like I love it, is when they do the one take through the whole office where they're lip syncing.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. That's so
much fun. And you can tell it's basically them, as the actors having fun and doing it. And then when Michael comes in at the end and does his magic really aggressively to them.
Yeah. Isn't Dwight licking a knife or something as well?
Yes, like, Dwight licks a knife.
It's just really strange.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Oh man, it's like you said. I just love this. I think it was a good one to kind of end this whole thing on, because it's, from what I hear, it's the biggest, like, most downloaded sitcom like ever, apparently, and you can see why. You know, I mean, we've just been chatting about all of these different characters and moments, and it's one of those shows I always recommend to people. Like, if you're just looking for an easy comedy to watch, I'm just like, yeah, just stick the US Office on. Like, just do it. You'll fall in love with it. Give it a chance. And like you say, even if you're a fan, you're a diehard fan of the UK one, that's great. The UK one's amazing for reasons that have already been discussed. Mm-hmm. But this is a whole other monster in itself. Like, for once it gets going. It's
and there's
just
like there's so much stuff we haven't spoken about as characters, we haven't even spoke about, like, what's Craig Robinson's character?
Oh, Daryl Philbin. I mean, what a find, man. That guy's hilarious. Like, he's so good.
And he ends up getting his own office and everything.
Yeah,
like,
he grows. Yeah,
it's,
it's really
great.
You just reminded me, I just have to say it, when he teaches Michael Scott slang, dink and flicker and stuff like that. Like, yeah, so again,
I'm watching it all from the beginning. I have to, it's been too long.
Yeah, but like you say, he's another one. I mean, like I said, we touched upon Melora Hardin as Jan. Levinson is absolutely incredible. She's just insane. I quite like Gabe Lewis, played by Zach Woods. I think he's really funny.
When he dresses as Lady Gaga, comedy gold. Because he's so awkward physically, and then you just see him being so tall standing in a blonde wig.
He's just smooth like a porpoise. He's just
brilliant.
He gets creepier as time goes on as well. Like,
yes.
There's so much great stuff in it, like you said, and
there's a prank that Jim does on him, actually, which is a really good one, which is uses the boss's biography, the one played by Kathy Bates, and this is a little bit far-fetched in terms of, I suppose it's only the beginning that Jim has to edit, and then it's just the audiobook of it, and plays it so that it's as if she's speaking on the phone to him and he has to make notes on the changes. It's so dumb, but it's brilliant that he would fall for something like that.
Again, I loved that, as someone who loves pranks and as someone who now does audio editing, like, watching that bit in particular, I'm just like,
in
that's
horror,
genius.
Pure horror.
I was just like, oh, that's evil. Like, that's actually really clever. Absolutely awesome. And then, like you said, there's so many other people that come in and out of this show. Mm-hmm.
Because Amy Adams is in it for like a couple of episodes. Rashida
Amy Ryan. Yeah, Rashida Jones is in it. Amy Ryan. You talk about Oscar-winning actresses, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
her as sort of Michael Scott's love interest, I think, is
perfect
casting.
They work so well together. She's the perfect, perfect casting, and such a great character because she's a big kid as well, and they really play on that. Oh, I was talking to someone about the PDA. Oh, we were watching the PDA episode.
Oh, that's the first thing I think of when
they're,
I think
like,
of them.
Playing with each other's hands.
It's so uncomfortable.
It's just hilarious because it is as if it's his first girlfriend, like, as a sort of 12-year-old. Brilliant.
Like, he cannot believe that somebody actually likes him for who
just
he is.
Sitting on his lap in the meeting, and it's just silly, really silly.
But it works. All of it works. I have to mention one of my absolute favorite recurring characters, a head writer on the show, and a man who has come up in multiple episodes because he's been responsible for some of the best sitcoms of the last 20 years. Mr. Michael Schur plays Moe's in this, Dwight's weird awkward cousin. So funny, man.
I don't think I've made that connection.
Oh, yeah. Very few people know. But yeah, once you see it, it's just... And because some of the stuff they get him to do is incredible.
Like, and it's brilliant because it's always played like in the background, kind of. It's like an like it's just happening and you're like, what?
Exactly. I mean, there's, I think one of the first introductions is with Dwight takes Ryan out on like a sales training, and it's this demented like obstacle course thing that he's getting him to do at his farm. And then at the last minute, like Mose jumps out and he has to wrestle Mose, and Mose is like dressed up. I think it says like fear or death on his jumper. And it's just like,
do you know what it reminds me of? It's as if Dwight was able to have cloned himself.
Yes.
But the clone wasn't able to have a life of his own. He just sort of stayed in the house and then just did Dwight's bidding. That's kind of what Mose
exactly. Exactly. And like his little weird awkward shuffle run that he does. And it makes it so much better when you know that that was one of the guys who was just heading this show and many
for sure.
others. Oh, it's incredible. It's like you said, it's the kind of show that it's wacky, it's weird, but it has so much heart and fun in it. And like, I don't know about you, I personally always tear up a bit when I watch the finale because I just think it's such a beautiful send off for everybody.
This is why I have to start again, because I get so attached to it. It's done really well, and I really like how, as I say, they do go back to the fact that this is something that was filmed in their lives as part of the TV show, and they get to watch back the first episode and everything. It's just very cyclical in nature, which is why it makes it so easy to just start again, and it makes me wonder if they did that on purpose.
that's a good point. And I think it's endless rewatch value. Like all the shows we've talked about, really, if once you sort of fall in love with it,
mm-hmm.
you'll find yourself constantly going back to it. So
definitely.
I loved it. Daisy, I want to know, is there anything else you want to talk about with this show? I mean, I'm sure we could sit here for like another 2-3 hours quite easily.
Yeah, just running through quotes moments. and moments. I just feel like Michael Scott in particular is just unlike any other character I've seen.
Yes.
In anything, and he holds a very dear place in my heart.
100%. 100%. Coming back to what we were saying at the start, that I think that is the crux of it. You know, if you see this show, like the moment you see his character, you're like, okay, no, this is going to be a completely different thing altogether. And Steve Carell, man, he deserves all the awards. Such
he
a good
really,
performance.
He really, really does. I think he should get them retroactively. Like,
100%.
Give him all the Emmys now.
Well, Daisy, thank you so much for coming in on this one. So for the good people at home listening, I'm sure they've listened to your friends episode, but if they haven't, of course they should go back and listen to that. But where can the good people find you if they haven't already heard that?
Sure thing. So if you want to check out anything that I'm sort of on socials, I'm on Twitter at Daisy Vic Edwards. On Instagram and Letterboxd at Daisy Victoria Edwards. And then we also have the W-rated podcast, which my co-host and co-creator Claire has been on your podcast as well, talking about Parks and Rec. We actually don't talk about things that we really, really love. We talk about things that we end up really hating because we watch the world's worst rated films, which is so worth the torture because the conversations we end up having are pretty crazy, and you know we're doing all of the hard work so you don't have to see what these, you know, hot piles of messes are. If you fancy hearing us torture ourselves, we're over at W-rated pod on Twitter and Instagram, and W-rated on Letterboxd as well.
Brilliant. And I do recommend that to people listening. So Daisy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And there we have it. A huge thank you to Daisy for coming onto the podcast and sharing your love of the US Office with us. I hope you guys listening enjoyed that episode just as much as I did. Definitely go and give Daisy a follow. You can find all of her social media links in the show notes of this podcast, as well as links to her podcast, W-Rated, which is hosted with her and previous guest, Claire. It's a wonderful show where they are diving through IMDb's bottom 100 movies. Go and subscribe today. I cannot recommend it enough. A big thank you as always to Alex, who designs the artwork for the show. If you like the look of the logo and what you see here, I've put all of his details in the show notes. You can contact him and commission him for your very own logo designs as well. And finally, I just want to give a big, big thank you to every single one of you who has been listening, who's been following, subscribing, recommending the show, telling a friend, telling an enemy, telling a neighbour, acquaintance, whomever you choose to tell. I'm very, very grateful that you do so. If you do it via social media, please don't forget to tag me in that. It is at FundamentalsPod at both Instagram and Twitter. You can, of course, email me if you have any feedback as well on the show, or if you'd like to even be a guest on the show. I'm open to topics and ideas for all sorts, really, especially now as we're wrapping up the sitcom summer series. It's been an absolute blast. I've had so much fun doing it. But we will be getting back to, well, relative normalcy here at the show. And that, of course, means exploring the rest of the pop culture zeitgeist with various guests and various topics. So again, I'm open to your ideas and I cannot wait to hear them. The last thing to say is if you have been kind enough to leave me a 5-star review on your favorite podcatcher, well, first of all, a big thank you. And second of all, please make sure you tell me. Again, you can reach me with all of the details I've just mentioned in the show notes. And I'd love to thank you in person on the podcast. That is about it for me. I'll be back again in a couple of weeks because I think I've earned a break. But I'll be back with another guest and another topic. So until next time, stay tuned and stay safe.